intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include U.S. health system wastes $760 billion per year and judges questioning work rules for Medicaid. And we'll begin with U.S. health system wastes $760 billion per year. Even a divided America can agree on this goal, a health system that is cheaper but doesn't sacrifice quality. In other words, just get rid of waste. A new study published this past week in JAMA finds that roughly 20% to 25% of U.S. health care spending is wasteful. It is a startling number, but not a new finding. What is surprising is how little we know about how to prevent it. William Schrank, a physician who is chief medical officer of the health insurer Humana and the lead author of the study, said, "One contribution of our study is that we show that we have good evidence on how to eliminate some kinds of waste, but not all of it." Following the best available evidence, as reviewed in the study, would eliminate only one quarter of the waste, reducing health spending by about 5%. Teresa Rogstad of Humana and Natasha Parekh, a physician with the University of Pittsburgh, were co-authors of the study, which combed through 54 studies and reports published since 2012 that estimated the waste or savings from changes in practice and policy. Because U.S. health spending is so high, almost 18% of the economy and over $10,000 per person per year, even small percentages in savings translates into huge dollars. The estimated waste is at least $760 billion per year. That's comparable to government spending on Medicare and exceeds national military spending, as well as total primary and secondary education spending. If we follow the evidence available, we would save about $200 billion per year, about what is spent on the medical care for veterans, the Department of Education, and the Department of Energy combined. That amount could provide health insurance for at least 20 million Americans, or three-quarters of the currently uninsured population. The largest source of waste, according to the study, is administrative cost, totaling $266 billion a year. This includes time and resources devoted to billing and reporting to insurers and public programs. Despite this high cost, the authors found no studies that evaluate approaches to reducing it. That doesn't mean we have no ideas about how to reduce administrative cost, said Don Berwick, a physician and senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and author of an editorial on the JAMA study. Moving to a single-payer system, he suggested, would largely eliminate the vast administrative complexity required by attending to the payment and reporting requirements of various private payers and public programs. But doing so would run up against powerful stakeholders whose incomes derive from the status quo. What stands in the way of reducing waste, especially administrative waste and out-of-control prices, is much more a lack of political will than a lack of ideas about how to do it. While the lead author works for Humana, he also has experience in government and academia, and this is being seen as a major attempt to refine previous studies of healthcare waste. Reflecting the study's importance, JAMA published several accompanying editorials. A co-author of one editorial, Ashish Jha of the Harvard Global Health Institute and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, said it's perfectly possible to reduce administrative waste in the system with private insurance. In fact, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and other countries with private payers have much lower administrative costs than we do. We should focus our energies on administrative simplification, not whether it's in a single-payer system or not. After administrative cost, prices are the next largest area the JAMA study identified as waste. The author's estimate for this is $231 billion to $241 billion per year on prices that are higher than what would be expected in more competitive healthcare markets, or if we imposed price controls common in many other countries. The study points to high brand drug prices as the major contributor. Although not explicitly raised in the study, consolidated hospital markets also contribute to higher prices. A variety of approaches could push prices downward, but something might be lost in doing so. High drug prices do motivate investment and innovation, said Rachel Sachs, an associate professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis. That doesn't mean all innovation is good or worth the price. It means we should be aware of how we reduce prices, taking into consideration which kinds of products and which populations it might affect, she said. Likewise, studies show that when hospitals are paid less, quality can degrade, even leading to higher mortality rates. Other categories of waste examined by the JAMA study encompass inefficient, low-value, and uncoordinated care. Together, these total at least $205 billion. With more than half of medical treatments lacking solid evidence of effectiveness, it is not surprising that these areas add up to a large total. They include things like hospital-acquired infections, use of high-cost services when lower-cost ones would suffice, low rates of preventative care, avoidable complications, and avoidable hospital admissions and readmissions, and services that provide little to no benefit. In addition to wasting money, these problems can have direct adverse health effects, lead to unwarranted patient anxiety and stress, and lower patient satisfaction and trust in the health system. And next, judges questioning work rules for Medicaid. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Friday sharply questioned the federal government's approval of Kentucky and Arkansas's plan requiring Medicaid recipients to work in order to maintain their health care coverage. People are going to lose coverage, and you haven't addressed that, Judge Harry Edwards said during oral arguments. The government argued that in order for states to maintain a certain level of quality of coverage for everyone, states can compel able-bodied adults that are covered by Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act to work for a certain amount of time each month to promote general physical health and financial stability. Medicaid is a government program that grants money to states to pay for some medical cost of eligible low-income individuals. In 2014, states were allowed to elect to participate in the Medicaid Affordable Care Act expansion, which made more people eligible for coverage. Alicia B. Klein, arguing for the Department of Health and Human Services, argued that the states are giving these people reasonable means to get the skills they need to transition to financial independence. If you keep borderline populations out of Medicaid, that frees up funds for others, she said, arguing that current Medicaid recipients who start to work may be able to gain commercial health care coverage through their jobs. Edwards pushed back, asking the government about the objective of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, and whether it is to ensure more people have health care coverage, or whether it is to help people ease into commercial health care markets. You're looking for objectives that are not in the statute, he said. Klein also suggested that these requirements would not only transition people from Medicaid to private health care coverage, but it would also save these states money that HHS alleges they are struggling to come up with. You have these states who have voluntarily chosen to participate in an ACA expansion of Medicaid. These states are struggling to make sure their expansions are on sound financial footing, Klein said. Lawyers representing the people at risk of losing coverage if these work requirements are permitted argued that these requirements would not necessarily result in people transitioning to another form of health care coverage, but would certainly cause massive losses in coverage. Cutting costs by reducing coverage is not acceptable, said Ian Gershengorn, an attorney from Jenner and Block and the National Health Law Program, a health rights advocacy group. He also brought up the objective of the ACA to provide health care coverage for more people, he said, as he argued that this provision doesn't follow that objective. Promoting financial independence is not a goal of the ACA, he said. Klein, on the other hand, argued that these provisions are a means of achieving the goals of the statute. If the health of Medicaid recipients improves from working, that makes the Medicaid program more effective and less costly, Klein said, referring to HHS's hope that getting able-bodied people to meet work requirements would also promote their general physical health. But Gershengorn argued health care coverage should not be conditioned on someone's physical well-being or their job status, which he alleged was what Klein was saying. Klein also compared Arkansas and Kentucky's work requirement provisions to those in assistance programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, and Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF. Judge David Sentell challenged her assertion, saying that Congress approved work requirements in TANF and SNAP, and that they could have done so for the ACA if they deemed it appropriate when it approved the law in 2010. Gershengorn echoed Sentell's sentiments. The government really is trying to blur SNAP, TANF, and AFDC, Assistance for Families with Dependent Children, on one hand, and Medicaid on the other hand, he said. There is no set date for a judge's ruling on the case, but the Justice Department has asked for an expedited decision. Depending on the decision, the suing Kentucky and Arkansas residents, or HHS, will have the option to appeal the case to the entire D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals or directly to the Supreme Court. At issue is a federal waiver HHS issued in November that approved changes to Kentucky's Medicaid program. The provisions championed by Republican Governor Matt Bevin imposed work requirements, mandatory monthly premiums, coverage lockouts, and more to the state's Medicaid plan. This and other health care legislation signed by Bevin, who is up for re-election next month, has been attacked by State Attorney General Andy Beshear, Bevin's Democratic opponent for governor. In order to enact these types of changes to Kentucky's Medicaid program, Bevin had to ask for a waiver from HHS, which they initially approved in January 2018. At that point, Kentucky was poised to become the first state in the nation to require Medicaid recipients to work or volunteer to qualify for health care coverage. The state predicted that 95,000 people would be forced off of Medicaid in Kentucky if Bevin's plan went into effect. Later in January 2018, 15 Kentucky plaintiffs filed a class action lawsuit, Stewart versus Azar, in federal court against HHS, claiming that the waiver put them at risk of losing their health care coverage. In June 2018, the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia sided with the residents, nullifying the federal government's approval. In his decision, Judge James Bolesberg called the approval of the waiver arbitrary and capricious. He sent the decision back to HHS for re-evaluation. In November 2018, HHS approved another waiver for changes to Kentucky's Medicaid plan, whose main provisions were virtually the same as the first one. The National Health Law Program predicts that this plan will cause hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians to lose their health care. They, along with the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, and the law firm Jenner & Block, represent more than 15 residents who are plaintiffs in a new lawsuit, again named Stewart versus Azar, who would lose health care coverage if the plan was approved. In March, Bolesberg, who presided over the case a second time, again sided with the Kentucky residents and sent the approval of the waiver back down to HHS for another re-evaluation. This time, HHS appealed the decision to the three judges panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit that heard oral arguments on Friday. Next, Silicon Valley changing its mantra of spending big and growing fast. Fred Wilson, a venture capitalist at Union Square Ventures, recently published a blog post titled The Great Public Market Reckoning. In it, he argued that the narrative that had driven startup hype and valuations for the last decade was now falling apart. His post quickly ricocheted across Silicon Valley. Other venture capitalists, including Bill Gurley of Benchmark and Brad Feld of Foundry Group, soon weighed in with their own warnings about fiscal responsibility. At some startups, entrepreneurs began behaving more cautiously. Travis VanderZeiden, chief executive of the scooter startup Bird, declared at a tech conference in San Francisco last week that his company was now focused on profit and not growth. The challenge is to try to stay disciplined, he said. The moves all point to a new gospel that is starting to spread in startup land. For the last decade, young tech companies were fueled by a wave of venture capital-funded excess, which encouraged fast growth above all else. But now some investors and startups are beginning to rethink that mantra and instead invoke turning a profit and generating positive unit economics as their new priorities. The nascent change is being driven by the stumbles of some high-profile unicorns, the startups that were valued at $1 billion and above in the private markets just as they reached the stock market. The most visible of those was the office rental startup WeWork, which dramatically ousted its chief executive and withdrew its initial public offering last month. At the same time, shares of Peloton, a fitness startup, and Smile Direct Club, an online orthodontics company, immediately cratered after the companies went public. And Uber, Lyft, and Slack, which also listed their stocks this year, have similarly dealt with falling stock prices for months. The lackluster performances have raised questions about Silicon Valley startup formula of spending lots of money to grow at the expense of profits. All of those companies lose money. Public market investors, it seemed, just weren't having it. A lot of these highly valued companies have run into the buzzsaw of Wall Street, where they're questioning or reminding us that profitability matters, said Patricia Nakachi, a partner at Trinity Ventures, a Silicon Valley venture capital firm. She added that she anticipated a ripple effect on private startup valuations that would start with the largest, most valuable companies and trickle down to the smaller, younger ones. For startups and investors that were used to heady times and big spending, that means it may be time for a reset. Aline Lee, an investor at Cowboy Ventures, a venture capital firm in Palo Alto, California, said she considered dusting off a four-year-old Winter is Coming email she had sent to startups in 2015, telling them to prepare for a downturn. She hasn't revived the warning yet, she said, because I worry about becoming the boy who cried wolf. Other venture capitalists are being more forward. At ENIAC Ventures, a venture firm in New York and San Francisco, the partners recently combed through their companies and identified the gross margins, a measure of profitability for each one, said Nihal Mehta, general partner of the firm. This was not something the firm regularly looked at, he said, but they were inspired by Wilson's cautionary blog post. They ultimately decided that in future meetings with entrepreneurs, they would push for more detailed financial models, even though the companies are very young, Mehta said. While ENIAC had looked at this when making investments before, it is now more important, he said. Tech startups have long gone through different cycles of fear. When the 2008 recession began, Sequoia Capital, one of the highest-profile venture firms, called a mass meeting with its startups and presented a slide deck entitled RIP Good Times that featured a graphic of a death spiral and a skull. The event was intended as a way to shock the startups into reining in cost to survive the downturn. Sequoia's presentation quickly became the talk of Silicon Valley, which did not fall into as deep an economic funk as the other parts of the United States. This year, the warnings are being revived. In his recent blog post, Wilson wrote that many of today's startups are focused on traditional physical industries, like real estate, exercise, or transportation. They should not command the high valuations that pure software companies, which tend to have less overhead, have, he wrote. In several message exchanges, Wilson said he has already seen that as criticism of WeWork mounted over the last month, some startup fundings were taking place at lower valuations and with stricter terms than the companies had hoped for. What I would like to see is a bit more rationality, and I'm hopeful we are going to get it, he said. By last week, his words appeared to be sinking in elsewhere. At a startup conference held by the tech publication TechCrunch at a San Francisco convention center, around 10,000 founders, investors, and innovators watched interviews with slightly more famous founders, investors, and innovators from a dark, cavernous room. On stage, entrepreneurs lamented the unforgiving stock market and challenging investment environment. Postmates, a food delivery startup that confidentially filed to go public in February, attended the confab. The company has not yet gone public because the markets have been choppy when it comes to growth companies, said Bastian Lehman, Postmates chief executive at the event. Bird, the scooter startup, announced $275 million in fresh funding at the conference. But its chief executive, Van der Zanden, said he was only able to raise that money because his unprofitable company had taken steps this year to shore up its losses. And next, Hulu to let you download and watch shows offline. If you are a fan of such Hulu programs as The Handmaid's Tale and its reboot of Veronica Mars, you can now take those shows with you when you're away from your home network or internet connection. Hulu, the Disney-owned streaming TV service, has finally joined the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime Video in letting its subscribers download shows and movies to watch offline. Hulu said individuals will be able to download up to 25 shows and have 30 days to watch those shows before having to download the programs again. There are two catches, however. For now, the downloadable option is available only for Apple iOS devices, but Hulu said the feature will soon come to Android mobile devices. Also, you have to be a subscriber to Hulu's $12.99 a month ad-free option in order to download videos. Hulu's downloadable show option comes as things are about to heat up in the streaming TV market. Apple is set to launch its $4.99 a month Apple TV Plus service on November 1st, and Disney will roll out its Disney Plus streaming service for $6.99 a month on November 12th. Disney is also going to offer a bundled package of Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, and Hulu with ads for $12.99 a month. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.